This is the first time I speak in the Amphithéâtre Richelieu, which is, of course, very, very impressive. Otherwise, thank you for inviting me, and I will give a short resume of what I have written in my paper, and I will dwell a little more on some of the implications that I see of coming out of this reconceptualization of organizations. To say it in a short way, looked at from the vantage point of methodological individualism, the social object formal organization, which has been separated and sort of made into something very special, loses all of the attributes justifying its existence as a distinct social object. This means that our idea of an organization as an instrument for the realization of goals is an illusion. An illusion and a delusion. We have a mental model of organizations, something like an instrument. It's simple, it is transparent, and it is sort of subordinated to formalized goals that have been formulated by its leaders. All of this is false. Organizations, even small ones, are complex, very complex, for good reasons. I'll come back to that. They are not transparent, never, because collective action needs transparency and opacity at the same time. Everything, too much transparency is unbearable in the long run. So organizations are never transparent. And they, of course, are not subsumed to formalized goals. They are not a unified normative space. There are all sorts of different logics of action in operation in an organization. Every manager knows that, and still they claim that organizations are defined by their mission and their formalized goals, which is, of course, not true. Like all structures of collective action, which organizations are, formal organizations are faced with three challenges that threaten their very existence. It's bounded interdependence, organizations organize interdependence, and people in organizations always try to limit the interdependence. Interdependence is something very difficult to live with. And so the basic ingredient of individual action in organizations is to try and gain some autonomy vis-a-vis the imposed interdependence. The organizations have to fight with bounded legitimacy. People inside organizations don't recognize the legitimacy that flows from the formal goals of the organizations. They have their own goals, and they have their own way of defining legitimacy. And of course, organizations are challenged by what we have been talking about all this morning, bounded rationality. By bounded rationality, I'm referring to the term coined by Simon, but of course it's much larger. It includes just the fact that people do what they think makes sense to them, whether that corresponds exactly to what the formal mission is another question. So, why is this? Well, the underlying problem, as I see it, is that we have thought that organizations have solved the problem of cooperation. They haven't. Cooperation is still a problem within organizations as much as outside of organizations. Cooperation is not a simple thing, and organizations have not done away with the root problem, which is the consequence of the unpredictability of human behavior. We have pretended that organizations make human behavior predictable. There are, you can write up a story of all the attempts that have been made to make humans predictable. All sorts of psychological theories, all the way to behavioral economics. It's all a delusion. Human behavior is not predictable because humans are, to a limited extent, always autonomous, to do something different. By autonomy, I mean the possibility to say no. No, not in a direct way, but no, simply by, to give an example, executing slowly the formal order they have been given. That changes everything. If somebody does not do with zeal what he's supposed to do, the organization breaks down. There are all sorts of examples of that. And the best of it is, of course, the strike by zeal. People don't go on strike. They just work according to the rules, and everything breaks down. So human behavior is not predictable in organizations. That means that moral hazard is central to organizations as it is outside of organizations. Can I trust my partner? If I can, I can cooperate. If I can't, I have to be cautious. Being cautious means I have to be able to live with the consequences of my partner not being trustworthy. The basic dilemma of organizations is Rousseau's hunter's dilemma. Can I wait until the guy brings the deer to me, or do I go after the rabbit? And in the short run, the rabbit is the better bet. Therefore, cooperation is a problem. Moral hazard is a problem. Here again, I think we could write up a story about how sociology and human sciences and have tried to sort of define away moral hazard. Not microeconomics. But I remember the resistance in my corporation, when microeconomics came out great in the late 80s, early 90s, when we were talking about moral hazard. And all sorts of theories were developed whereby human beings are congenitally altruistic. They are not. Human nature is not basically altruistic. Human nature is, as Rousseau has told us, and as many other people have told us, is complicated, it's complex, it is both altruistic and egotistic. But in doubt, one cannot trust that the other one will be altruistic. That's the basic problem of organization. The stakes may vary, but the problem remains the same. Human behavior is unpredictable, and no way of psychologizing or moralizing, another way of doing this, can do away with this inescapable fact. People are autonomous not to do what they're expected to do. They have this possibility, and the very possibility is enough to complicate the whole scheme of organized action. So the instrument we have invented to steer collective action, organization, does not guarantee that the desired outcomes will be delivered. If we think that it does, that's the instrumental view of organizations, all technocrats have. I define the goal and I define the organization, the procedures, and then everything's fine. Whereas organizational sociology, taken seriously, will tell him that the whole thing starts at that point. Will the goals be attained? Will people follow exactly what they're supposed to do? And all of this is unpredictable. Therefore, the accumulated, composed outcome is, of course, unpredictable too. So the instrument that we have wielded to steer collective action is in itself, produces in itself unpredictable outcomes. So Merton's paradigm of the unexpected consequences of purposive social action pertains within organizations as much as without. And that's the big delusion of organization theory. Organization theory tells us that Merton's paradigm does not apply in organizations. It's something that doesn't stand up to serious analysis. So this is the basic outcome or the basic result of when you look at organizations from a methodological individualistic perspective. People are free not to do what they're supposed to do. Therefore, the whole idea of role system falls apart. Role systems are role systems, but what people actually do is another thing. So what are the implications of such a reconceptualization of organizations? I may be driving home a point that's very obvious to you. It is not obvious to managers. It is not obvious to technocrats doing public policy. They all believe and strongly believe that it is enough to define an organization, to define the procedures, and everything will follow. That this is not the fact is just a testimony of their blindness, not of the fact that this analysis is not true. So what are the implications of such a reconceptualization? I would like to dwell on two domains. The first is how to think about and deal with purposive social action or social intervention. The first idea is, of course, that it's an encouragement to be modest. Modesty is the first implication. Modesty in the ambitions of social engineering. Neither the quality nor the enlightened nature of the goals to be pursued, nor the sheer logical or analytical quality of the rules and procedures invented for their implementation can guarantee that the expected outcome will be delivered. This is true in public policy as much as it is true within organizations. Maybe I should add that what follows from everything I just said is that the good metaphor is societies when we talk about organizations. Organizations are just a more formalized part of society. And it's not the other way around. It's not society should be an organization. Organizations are like a society. They are imperfect. They are incomplete. They never succeed in being what they're supposed to be. So it's a basic incompleteness of organization that I'm talking about. So the goals and the procedures that we invent to make sure that we attain a certain state of affairs is no guarantee because it does not do away with the capacity of people to do otherwise. Because of local circumstances that make it necessary for them to do differently. Not because they don't want to do what they are supposed to do, but because it's not possible. And the people up there who define the goal and the procedures just don't know enough about the real conditions of implementation to take account of that, and they wouldn't, and they couldn't, because it makes everything so complicated. So, goals, second implication, goals are much less important than the process of implementation that will take us where they're supposed to take us. Implementation is the most important word in all of this. Here again, sounds like pure common sense. It is not for managers. Yes, they will pay lip service to it, or technocrats. Managers and technocrats, for me, are the same thing. They will pay lip service to it, but then forget it. And they think, and they still believe, that the goal is the important thing and the rest will follow. No, the rest does not follow. So that means that we have to give close attention to the observation of the actual consequences of what we have undertaken. And that means we have to be able to distance ourselves from the goals that we have set as managers or as government, policymakers. Are we attaining what we are, what we want to attain? Are we accomplishing what we want to accomplish, or is the end effect of what we have accomplished with enlightened goals the opposite of what we wanted to obtain? Implementation is a process full of surprises because of the unpredictability of human behavior, the irreducible unpredictability of human behavior. And so the implementation process cannot be streamlined. It has to be followed, and it has to be diagnosed ex post, not ex ante. So it's observation ex post of what happened that is the basic ingredient for managerial or policy action. That's a completely different view of what intervention can do. It also has an implication of what we can think of change. Change is not a moral problem. It's not a problem, a question of conversion. A desired change in behavior cannot be obtained directly, never. You can convince somebody for a time, but you're never guaranteed that what you have persuaded him to do will last. It's the lasting aspect of behavior that is so important. You never know what circumstances will happen to that person and how those circumstances, I'll come back to that, force him to change his behavior or induce him to change his behavior because it seems intelligent from his perspective or her perspective at that time. So it's not a question of conversion. It's a question of structuring and restructuring contexts of action. That's a word that I'll come back to. Contexts of action. Organizations are contexts of action. They're, and the basic behavior of people is dependent on the structuration of these contexts of action. So all we can do is try to structure or restructure contexts of action and then pray to God that they will have, these restructuring will have the desired consequence. We'll never know unless we observe it ex post. The implementation process has to be understood as something which is basically distributed, it's under the discrete control of nobody, and all participate in it by their action, reaction, action, interaction, reaction. So the outcome of implementation processes is always distributed. It's very difficult to pinpoint the responsibility, an individual responsibility. It's a distributed effect. It's like Raymond Boudon's composition effects. So the result of collective action, that's another big problem, is always ambiguous. We will have to interpret it, whether we think it is in the desired direction or not. And that's going to be a political problem as much as it is a cognitive problem. So those are my reflections on the first domain of implications. The second domain of implications of what I sort of outlined seems to me to pertain to our sociological thinking, to how we go about structuring our ways of studying social reality. Methodological individualism is about the conditions of human choice. That's the way I understand it. Human choice is never individual, purely individual. It is always relational, meaning always tainted by the relational constructs within the constraints of which humans have to act and have to adopt, and to which they have to adapt their behavior. There is always somebody else, not just one person, always somebody else. As a consequence, it seems to me that sociological theorizing has to be rooted in the clinical study of these very contexts of actions and their constraints. And that means that basically we can only know locally, not how do we go up, how do we go to the macro level. It's a big question. I have no real solution. My solution to it is what I taught my students. You have to study the field. The field is, in this way, defined as the relevant context of action for individuals. That's a big question already. What is the relevant context of action of anybody? Once you have that relevant context of action, then you can understand, and you can really understand, in Weber's sense, behavior. That doesn't mean you can predict it, but you can understand it ex post. It's not the same thing. The best example I have of the fertility of such an approach is a recent book by a French anthropologist, Olivier de Sardin, who wrote a book that's called The Revenge of Context. And it's a critique of the technocratic logic of development economics and development efforts of development in the underdeveloped world. What he does is he sort of sums up the comparison between an enormous amount of clinical studies, field studies in Africa, and shows how these contexts intermediate whatever the goals and procedures of development models are. And the contexts account for the difference in the results of the same models. So it's a very big and important critique of the way we think about development. But it's also a critique in the way we think about theorizing. He only theorizes through comparison of clinical studies. The real basis of his theorizing are clinical studies and the comparison between them and the regularities and differences that these comparisons reveal. And to me, this is the way we should go about doing sociology. That's the way I have practiced with my doctoral students, and I was known of saying, where do you start? Where do you start? You don't start with literature, you start by going out and looking at how people behave and trying to make sense of that. Then you understand what's going on in the field, and then you can understand what happens to the technocratic visions that are injected into that context from above. So what this amounts to, in a way, is that our social theorizing is always a conjecture based on rigorous comparison of a sample of clinical case studies. But it's nothing more than a conjecture. It's like Crozier's bureaucratic phenomenon. The bureaucratic phenomenon is based on two case studies, clinical, deep case studies that give you good understanding of a whole lot of meaningful behavior in bureaucracies. And he then sort of starts developing a theory out of that, which is a conjecture, but it's based on something that's solid, much more solid than other sociological theories that I know of. So, to me, sociological knowledge and understanding of social dynamics must build on the clinical study of local contexts of action. So it's a local knowledge that we can build, local knowledge that is that we can be pretty sure of. The rest is conjecture. That's not bad. I mean, you can do very interesting things with conjecture, but you shouldn't sell it as a certainty. It's a conjecture. This is true in organizations. Basic instinct of a good organizational sociologist is when he comes to meet a policymaker or a higher up manager is, let me go down and see what's happening, and then we'll talk. Then I can tell you things. Otherwise, I'm just aping what you tell me. So our knowledge and understanding of social dynamics must build on the clinical study of local contexts. I couldn't stress this idea enough. This is true in organizations, but it also is true for more overarching social processes like the ones we're living in. You know, our policymakers have gone crazy with ideas and big projects and what have you. It's important to remind all of those policymakers that they theorize and then things happen. And unless they become interested in what's happening, they will just build castles in the air. Thank you.